The local economy in the region is a mix of businesses old and new, all with a common thread. Someone had an idea and pursued the idea all the way up to the opening the doors on a new business. We visit with entrepreneurs and sometimes the descendants of entrepreneurs in our monthly business segment, The Ground Floor. This month, we visit with the co-founders of one of the region's many cannabis-based businesses. Grown Rogue describes itself as a vertically integrated business selling marijuana and related products, a seed-to-sale business. Let's hear what it's like to get into a business that was not legal a few decades ago, or a few years ago, really. Sarah Strickler and Obi Strickler are the co-founders of Grown Rogue. Obi, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Sarah Strickler, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks.
Apologies to the audience. I had to run down the stairs to get you guys, so a little breathless on the other end of that. So good to have you both here. Give us the story about what you guys were doing before you got into Grown Rogue.
Yeah, we have quite a history in the cannabis space. So we started a small medical marijuana company in the mid-2000s that was really focused on understanding the culture, the product, you know, the innovation that we saw that was coming to this industry as the perception of the public began to change. Simultaneously, I had a career in the natural resource industry. So we did a lot of, you know, local permitting, community engagement, you know, other things that were really, you know, pertinent to confrontational or controversial industries. And so when we saw the opportunity in the recreational legalization coming into the cannabis space, you know, we saw a great opportunity to bolt those two skill sets together, the industry knowledge in the medical space with understanding kind of local requirements. And really with a focus on education, community, and bringing quality products into the industry.
So you're saying that being involved with products that had some level of controversy kind of helped you get into this this business?
I think it helps you understand the perspective and the concerns that community members have as you bring in a new industry into an area. You know, we're seeing a lot of that in Jackson and Josephine counties and across other states that we work in, where there's just a lot of misconception around what the industry is trying to do and trying to overcome some of those stereotypes and educate people around the, you know, the true benefits of, you know, medical cannabis and the health and wellness component of our sector.
So that is your prime focus. You're saying that it's less recreational and more therapeutic?
We do both. I mean, what we believe is everything in moderation and that there's a real big opportunity for people to look at this from a medical standpoint, whether it's pain relief, anxiety, but also from a health and wellness component, like a adult use category. So people looking to replace, you know, having a beverage at night for relaxation, you know, looking to enhance their experiences when they're doing outdoor activities, things of that nature.
So let's get an idea of the product line of Grown Rogue. Sarah Strickler, can you run us through some of the things you make and offer?
Yeah, so mainly we're a flower producing company, but we also have derivatives as well as shatter, wax, concentrates, things along those natures.
I noticed shatter. I don't understand shatter. What does that mean?
Shatter is, well, I'll have Obi really speak to this. He's probably...
So there's really all the products start with the base genetic, which is the flower. You move from flower into all these different derivatives. So a lot of people are now making pre-rolls, which is just like a cannabis cigarette. And then a big factor of where people are moving to is into the derivative products. And so when you talk about like a shatter or a concentrate, it's essentially extracting the more of a purity of the products. So you're removing all the chlorophyll, the biological components of the cannabis flower, and really just focusing on the cannabinoids that come out of that. So shatter is a very specific concentrate component. We're seeing a lot of movement and uptick in cartridges, which is kind of like a vaporizer, like an e-cigarette almost. And, you know, a lot of people are moving into live resin products and things like that that really pull out the, you know, the taste and the terpene profiles of the product.
So is shatter consumed directly or is it put into other products or both?
So shatter is consumed directly. They're called dab rigs. It's essentially a way to volatilize like a pure piece of oil relatively quickly.
So you mentioned the fact that you've been working around cannabis for a few years and had some expertise with it on the medical end of it. So it sounds like it was a pretty easy transition into the legal recreational market.
I wouldn't say easy. Mm-hmm. Anytime you commit your life and your focus into a business, there's always challenges that come with that. And then the transitionary period is actually one of the inflection points that Grown Rogue identified from, you know, medical, which is, you know, it's a smaller market. Normally it's less regulated. and transitioning that into the recreational space where you really create a fully, you know, legalized, you know, holistic business. And while we come with expertise, it really helped us understand the culture of the industry, you know, who the people were, you know, where the consumers were looking for in terms of innovative product development. You know, that's where we really see Oregon as being a step ahead of most of the other states in the U.S. is we have a very experienced and mature consumer base. And so that transition, you know, I think we were as well prepared as anyone getting into it, has obviously been, you know, it's been challenging to kind of, you know, build a business around that, you know, understand the branding, the marketing, what the consumer's looking for. You know, really the community work that Sarah does such a good job on in terms of changing, you know, the perspective of how people look at the industry. You know, it's one of the big things that was really important to Sarah and I as we started this was, you know, how do we make sure we build it in a way that the community, our families, you know, our peers can be proud of.
So let's talk about that, Sarah. What kinds of venues do you go to seek people out? How do you talk to people? One-on-one, in groups, a combination thereof?
Yeah, a combination. Being local, being from this area, really has helped me and the company be able to put ourselves out there more. I would say my deep roots in this community have helped to educate, and we do a lot of tours. I've tried to get on with the chamber, the various chambers here in the community. And just really the education component of really just sharing the message and trying to be open and transparent and allowing people to come in and see the processes in which we do really has helped overcome some of the stigmas.
How grudging was the acceptance at work? How sticky was the stigma still?
You know, I think it's still out there. Obi and I, we have 3 children, and I think that that's been one of the issues as well, just coming out as a parent in this industry that, you know, has a lot of controversy. But Obi has been in controversial work, you know, most of his life, coming from with his geology background. So it's nothing new to us.
Geology as relates to the exploration for oil, things like that?
We did natural resources. So I ran an environmental permitting company for a number of years here locally, actually. Went into the natural resource sector where we did mostly a large project development.
What kinds of projects?
We had copper projects across the world. I did a little bit of, I wouldn't call it oil and gas work. We were looking at some hypervelocity technologies that had an application in that sector.
All right. So obviously, like we said, with some controversy. But so the idea, though, have you gotten to a point where you feel like the chambers of commerce accept? I mean,
yeah.
It seems like that's a major stamp of approval right there.
Yes, it is. You know, just showing them how we're doing it differently than others, and just being true to the community. Community is everything to me, and having it be something that our children and ourselves and, as Obi alluded to, just the community at large to be proud of.
So, Obi, you talked about the culture of the cannabis business, which I have to assume is changing somewhat, because you've got a lot of people who I don't think would have been in it before getting into it now. I suspect some of the people who had been in it for a long time when it was underground are getting out or switching things up or something. But, I mean, how much transition do you see just from what little time you've been in the cannabis business?
I think you're really seeing is the intersection of, you know, kind of how the industry was originally built. I mean, this is what I call the immature, mature industry. And I say that because it's been mature for 50, 100 years that people have been, you know, producing, selling, you know, making products in the cannabis sector, but they've never been building business. And as you try and integrate, like, again, going back to that culture, like how this industry was built and the people's passion for, you know, medical benefits, health and wellness, with the fact that you have to have, you know, like we're a publicly traded company now, you have to have auditable financials, you have to have the right legal representation, you have to have, you know, compliance. You know, there's a big accounting component to what we do as you're navigating, you know, the different federal restrictions. And, you know, I think embracing that together has been one of the most challenging things the industry has faced is, you know, how do you get that historical precedent that was sent that was really kind of a counterculture type approach, you know, almost anti-establishment, with the fact that cannabis is now becoming mainstream. And we internally, you know, battle that every single day about how, you know, our team relates to different things, you know, the expectations we have. And it continues to probably be one of the most focused efforts that we create every day inside of the company.
Now, because of the continued federal prohibition, you probably still have some issues with how you handle cash flow, which is a literal cash flow, right? Yeah. You can't write checks for things. I mean, how can you be a publicly traded company when you still have the federal prohibition in place?
Lots of transparency. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the reasons we did that. We didn't go public for some sort of exit or other kind of financial benefit. What we saw there was an opportunity to really take the platform that we built in Oregon and expand it into the different states that we now operate in. So we have assets in California. We just expanded into Michigan. You know, we continue to look at other opportunities across the U.S.
It sounds like as states turn legal, then you get footholds in those markets.
Yeah.
Michigan just went there, right?
Yeah, Michigan will. They just approved it in December of 2018. They'll start accepting recreational licenses in early 2020. So we really like that opportunity. It's a good state. But I think, you know, there's a lot of misconception around how the industry operates. It's one of the things that Sarah and I really focus on is trying to educate people around the realities of what's happening in the industry. One of the common ones you hear about is banking. And it's true, it's harder to bank in our industry, but there is plenty of banking options. And so for the companies that are doing a good job of integrating, again, back to that, the culture of the industry, but building a business, we have to understand on one side what the consumer is looking for from a product standpoint, but we also have to be able to write checks, send wires, have payroll, things of that nature. And so we have several banks that we work with that have taken the step into the recreational cannabis that are in full compliance with all of, you know, FINRA, FinCEN, you know, all of the federal requirements, which allows us to have standard banking practices in the U.S.
It sounds like you could spend many hours a day just dealing with the regulations that constrain it without turning out any product at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's the business side. But, you know, coming from the natural resource sector and other business that I've run, each business has its own particular challenges that you have to, you know, overcome. And whether it's medical, restaurants, I mean, the media businesses that people are in, you know, we all have the challenges that we have to overcome. And I think cannabis is no different. It just has its own unique set of challenges that you have to deal with.
This is The Ground Floor on the Jefferson Exchange, our monthly visit with entrepreneurs. This time around, it's Sarah and Obi Strickler, the co-founders of Grown Rogue, which is described as a seed-to-sale cannabis company, vertically integrated. You can join our conversation on the Exchange. Questions or comments for our guests about how they approach their business or the business they're in, which was not a legal business not so many years ago. So, Sarah, how long has there been a Grown Rogue entity? How long ago did you guys start this?
Just right about 3 years. Mm-hmm. We started, like Obi said, in the medical space, and then we transitioned our medical gardens over into the rec space in 2017.
And you have both indoor and outdoor grows? Is that
right?
We do.
Mm-hmm. do. We currently have three farms, type tier two, and then we also have an indoor facility, 17,000 square foot indoor facility. And then we just took on the greenhouse as well.
Tier two means what?
It's a type of license that you can obtain in the rec space.
Different license categories inside of Oregon. So for cultivation, right, there's really four license types in Oregon that you can get. There's cultivation license, distribution, processing, and then retail. And within cultivation, there's two primary licenses. One is called a tier one, which has a certain square footage restriction. And then tier two is the largest, which allows us to cultivate up to 40,000 square feet for outdoor and then 10,000 square feet for indoor.
So are you in all four of those realms, though, that you mentioned? Are you in cultivation, distribution, processing, and retail?
The only license we don't hold in Oregon is a retail license. We really saw the future of the industry is in the brands, and it's a consumer packaged good industry. And while retail was an opportunity for connection to a consumer, you can do that through other channels. And while we like the retail model, you know, we've seen a big shift in other industries where retail and storefronts are essentially being eliminated. There's more direct-to-consumer, you know, online ordering. Those aren't available for cannabis yet, but as we predict into the future of where the industry is going, you know, it's all about, you know, being where the football is going to be thrown, not where, you know, you were standing. And so really looking ahead to our focus on branded products.
It sounds like, to continue with the football, where it's going to be thrown metaphor, you've picked the spot in the field where you think it's going to go. It sounds like you're really poised to get into these markets that are not yet available to you.
Yeah, and going back to Oregon, we look at it as the most advanced cannabis market in the world. I mean, you've seen tons of price compression, oversaturation in terms of product. I mean, even though that's been changing, as you look at the pendulum swings in commodity markets, and, you know, early on, we understood the future is in the brands. So really focusing on building quality, innovative, trustworthy, transparent products so that consumers can, you can really build a relationship with a consumer. Because the industry's so early, once you establish a relationship with a consumer, it's going to be very hard to break that. So our focus is on getting that as much as possible, as early as possible.
You mentioned the price compression and the oversaturation by the mm-hmm. state of Oregon's count. There's six and a half years worth of product already made.
Yeah.
Nobody would need to grow any for the next few years then. So how do you deal with that in terms of what it does to your price structure? And then, I mean, have you made any changes to your production processes based on what you see as the glut?
This is actually very interesting. This, and I think I said earlier about the misconceptions in the industry and like the media and mm-hmm. what they presume. There's actually a dearth of, or there's a lack of product in the market right now, which you'll laugh and say, hey, this is like,
okay, so help me understand why the state of Oregon says there's so much and you say there's not that.
I'm just telling you from being on the ground mm-hmm. and we have about 130,000 square feet of cultivation, and our market demands about twice as much as we produce. And so we fulfill a lot of our, our demand, our marketplace demand with our various products by mm-hmm. purchasing third-party product and either selling it direct or changing it into some of our derivative products that we produce. And in the last couple months, we've had a really hard time sourcing adequate product to meet our demand. And so it's been consistent. And so I think one of the challenges you see is the media is not always correct in the way they articulate certain problems in industries. You know, I've seen that across various businesses I've worked in. Number two is the industry changes very quickly. It's very volatile. And number three is sometimes when you report like the compliance and the metric numbers, you know, some of those are like wet weights. And wet weights, you know, a lot of the moisture is removed, and so the dry weights are a much different number. But I can tell you as one of the larger operating companies in the state, there's a lack of product today.
Where did it go? I mean, if there was a glut, I mean, there was price compression. People mm-hmm. in the business, in addition to you, have said that's happened. You just said it too. But so if there was a glut, where did all the extra product go?
I think you have two things going on. Number one is, time will tell what the correct regulatory structure was. So Oregon took a very unique approach, which is they did an unlimited license, a true free market. And what happens with that is you actually drove prices to a point that competed with the former illicit market. And so when you have a transparent, tested, diverse product line in a safe location, all the people who are buying cannabis in Oregon are now going to a shop. So you've increased the demand, right? No, people aren't going to their corner dealer anymore to buy product. Number two is because of that massive price compression, a lot of people who started a business that were either undercapitalized or had this, kind of short-term, I'm going to put a Tier 2 license in, I'm going to grow some marijuana, and I'm going to retire in 6 months, didn't have the wherewithal or the commitment to continue forward. So you saw companies going out of business or not replanting or not continuing. And so you couple an increase in demand, a decrease in cultivation supply, and essentially you start to balance again. I mean, I've done a lot, like even in the natural resource sector, working in some commodity businesses. When you see a volatile shift in pricing that is 300 to 400% reduction in a span of 6 months, it doesn't go that fast and sit. You expect to see, it's like a pendulum. You know, that pendulum doesn't just move to one side and stall. Mm-hmm. It swings back.
Because so people buy at that low price?
They buy, or it's natural conditions. When you have an oversupply and lower price, people stop producing. And because of our industry is unique in the outdoor production, which is a lot of where that oversupply comes from, if you miss that window to plant, the refurbishment of that supply could be 12 to 18 months. It's not like a normal manufacturing process where you might shut down, a manufacturing line and say, hey, we're going to wait for 2 months until, prices rebound. And then we'll turn it back on, and we're producing our widget again in 3 weeks.
But this is still a farm product, and so you have a yearly cycle.
Still a farm product. So your cycle times are much longer to produce it.
So, Sarah, you mentioned three facilities. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And then so how many employees do you have at Grown Rogue?
We currently have 42 employees, mm-hmm. yeah.
Full-time, part-time, some mix thereof?
Yeah, a mix thereof, but most are full-time.
And how about investors? You mentioned you're publicly traded. So I mean, do you have are there a bunch of people who own chunks of Grown Rogue? Or?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, being a publicly listed security, you know, our investor base continues to grow every day as people buy and sell the securities on the exchange that we operate. When we originally started the business, you know, Sarah and I seeded the company, you know, with our own money, you know, kind of called the seed round or whatever we put into it to get the original operations up and running. Then we raised, you know, from a variety of different kind of high net worth individuals in Oregon, California, and then a couple other states, but mostly on the West Coast. And then as part of our going public round, we raised some money out of individuals in Canada. And so our investor base has gotten pretty broad over the last, you know, call it 12 to 18 months.
It sounds like it's been quite a whirlwind. Do you ever turn around and go, wow, we have done so much in the last 3-4 years?
We absolutely do. I think sometimes we lose sight of that it's moving so fast that we don't pat ourselves on the back enough. We're just continuing to push forward because we have such a big goal in front of us.
And it sounds like you're really working hard to make sure you keep up with every state that does add cannabis,
yep.
and it's happening all the time. Michigan, as we gave it as an example.
Yeah, with the federal restrictions, you know, we can pick up our IP, we can pick up our business models, but we can't ship product. And so in each state, you know, you have your own regulatory environment, but you have to be able to pick up your, you know, the things that you can take multi-state.
If you could take your things multi-state, I mean, how would that be like, would that be a huge boon to you?
We believe there will be another massive shift in the industry as federal deregulation occurs. That's the next big transition of where you'll see a lot of value created. And one of the reasons we like being in Oregon, not because the state is viewed as a, you know, a great cannabis market, as you compare, like, say, a Michigan or a Florida or, you know, some of these other more restricted markets. But, you know, over the last 50 years, cannabis has become synonymous with Southern Oregon and Northern California.
All right. So having a name like Grown Rogue certainly helps.
Yep.
Sarah and Obi Strickler, our guests in this month's edition of The Ground Floor. Thanks again to Sin Shure for bringing them in. And thanks to you for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We really appreciate it.
That'll do it for this hour of The Exchange. Stay tuned for more.